540 AM Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper in Chicago. Hawaii Governor Josh Green says 38% of the wildfire area in Lahaina has been searched and 110 people have died, but with hundreds still unaccounted for.
There's now going to be another about 225 relief individuals coming. It's three teams of 75. The capacity is increasing continuously to make sure that we can go to every corner of the disaster site.
President Biden and the First Lady will visit Maui on Monday. CBS's Lilia Luciano reports from Wailuku.
Joe Schilling was on his way to his friend Corey Blue's home when the fires were raging all around him.
He was texting me that now there are four houses burning and then cars exploding on the road. I said, try and get out. He said, we can't get out. We can't see. We can't breathe.
Blue believes her friend died in the fire trying to help others evacuate, but his remains have not been found.
Former President Trump could be juggling quite a packed schedule after his fourth criminal indictment, this time in Georgia, over alleged efforts to overturn his 2020 election loss. CBS's Nicole Killian in Atlanta with details.
District Attorney Fani Willis has proposed a March 4th trial date in her racketeering case against former President Trump and his co-defendants, creating a possible calendar crunch that's one day before Super Tuesday and weeks before Trump is set to go on trial in Manhattan, all sandwiched between two potential special counsel trials in January and May.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken spoke by phone with Paul Whelan, who has been detained in Russia since 2018. CBS's Olivia Gazis has the latest.
A source familiar with the call told CBS News the secretary told Whelan to, quote, keep the faith, and that the U.S. was doing everything it could to bring him home. It's the second time the two have spoken.
Five Texas families with transgender children are suing the state over its new law that bans puberty blockers, hormone treatments, and gender-related surgeries for minors. They want a Travis County judge to block the law from taking effect on September 1st. The ACLU's Brian Klosterboer.
It violates every parent's fundamental right to make health care decisions for their children based on evidence and science.
The fate of the Texas ban is now in the hands of a state judge in Austin. The legal battle over a widely used abortion pill appears to be headed to the Supreme Court. CBS Evening News anchor Nora O'Donnell with more.
A federal appeals court in New Orleans said it would limit access to mifepristone, saying the FDA overstepped its authority by making it easier for women to get the drug. Access to the pill won't immediately change, but the ruling likely sets up a Supreme Court showdown with the Biden administration expected to appeal.
This is CBS News.
If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Their end-to-end hiring system helps you attract, interview, and hire candidates all in the same place. Visit Indeed.com/credit.
Looking for more local programming? Check out our website, civicmedia.us, to see our entire lineup.
With news on WAUK The Shaw, I'm Stuart J. Waddles. There's a caution flag flying at Lake Michigan beaches in the area.
A beach hazard statement is in effect through late tonight for the beaches along Lake Michigan. High waves climbing up to 6 feet and strong currents are expected as winds gust across the open water up to 40 miles per hour. This will result in a dangerous swim risk, especially at beaches in Sheboygan and Ozaukee counties, with a moderate risk further south. Keep in mind, thunderstorms are expected late this evening and overnight, too, as a cold front moves through the area. I'm meteorologist Brittany Merlot, Civic Media News.
A pedestrian plaza is coming to West Allis. The city has been awarded an almost $30,000 grant from the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation to convert a downtown side street into a pedestrian plaza. Leaders hope to use the project to improve the area's image. Construction is planned for this summer. With news on WAUK The Shaw, I'm Stuart J. Waddles.
When you're high, you feel different. You think different, you talk different, you draw different, you listen to music different, but you probably knew that. Problem is, you also drive different, and not in a good way. That's why driving high is illegal everywhere. So if you're high, just don't drive. Make a plan to get a sober ride. Because if you feel different, you drive different. Brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Don't let biased algorithms or degree screens or exclusive professional networks or stereotypes. Don't let anything keep you from discovering the half of the workforce who are stars. Workers skilled through alternative routes rather than a bachelor's degree. It's time to tear the paper ceiling and see the stars beyond it. Find out how you can make stars part of your talent strategy at tearthepaperceiling.org. Brought to you by Opportunity at Work and the Ad Council.
The RPG came through the belly of the aircraft. We don't talk about the female combat wounded. These are our daughters and our sisters and our mothers. Wounded Warrior Project came into my life and taught me how to stand back up and get back in the fight. The truth is, I think we all have this strength inside of us, but until you're tested, you just don't know it's there.
See how Wounded Warrior Project empowers women veterans like Beth by visiting woundedwarriorproject.org/empowerwomenvets.
Your hometown radio, refreshed. Keeping you informed, entertained, and connected on the Civic Media Network, civicmedia.us.
Singers out there who are so-called originalists, textualists, are delighted about the decision since it honors the words of the Montana Constitution. You're welcome. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com.
Are you tired of think tank approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I got to tell you, in looking at the media coverage of the fourth Trump indictment, the New York Times grabbed my attention because their headline page, it's kind of like you got like a third of the column with the headline being indictment is in over bid to flip vote in Georgia. It doesn't even mention really Trump. And if you didn't know, you wouldn't know what it is. Oh, that's just, you know, who knows? But you would then be focused to the more important story, which is a teen sentenced to life is making a case for release. That's the important story for democracy right there. It's curious. Why that? Curious. The New York Times, who's supposed to be so liberal, so far, so anti-Trump. Curious how that happens. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on, well, the media coverage of the what I'm calling the cycle. Trump is now hit for the cycle. He's got four separate indictments, and he wanted all four of them. But I've asked Craig Harrington to come talk with us. Craig is the research director at Media Matters, mediamatters.org, the website. Craig, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, thank you for having me again.
So what do you make of this headline? I mean, am I reading too much into this? I mean, because I'm looking at this, I'm going, it just doesn't fit with everywhere else where big, bold Trump indicted, or it seems a little soft.
Yeah, you know, there are a couple of things at play here. And I think to be charitable to the New York Times, they probably are assuming that their readers know who is being indicted. You know, he's kind of the most famous person in the world, and his now criminal saga has dominated the news for most of the past, well, more than a year. This really began with some New York Times and Washington Post reporting in February, I believe, of 2022, when the sort of the Mar-a-Lago documents scandal first sort of bubbled up into the public's view. I imagine they think that their readers know who was indicted. But also you do have to think, like, they try to be a little heterodox with their headline writers. They try to kind of make a point with them. I apologize for that noise. They try to make a point with their headlines and try to not sort of follow the pack. But you also do have to understand, like, the New York Times, they really do take that liberal bias criticism to heart. Yeah. And it does affect the way that they cover the news. And their political desk is, frankly, very conservative, small c conservative, but very conservative in its coverage of major news and scandals, particularly those involving their very outspoken Republican opponents, because they just don't want to fight with them. They don't want to be seen as being, a liberal rag. And as a result, by sort of attempting so studiously to avoid politicizing their news coverage, they accept the sort of Republican framing often and end up politicizing it just toward the Republican preferences. And I'd be remiss if I didn't remind your listeners of how the New York Times has covered Trump, you know, rigorously and authoritatively, but not with the sort of like vindictiveness that we saw their coverage of Hillary Clinton's, you know, email protocol usage. And it's important to realize that as much attention as this Trump story has gotten, and it has gotten a dominating amount of attention, I think it's probably on par with, you know, whether or not Hillary Clinton used her work email or her private email for work and vice versa, which was unimportant in the grand scheme of things. 7 years hence, that was an unimportant thing that happened in American history, and it totally altered the course of human events and the trajectory of the 21st century because of how the New York Times covered that story.
You're absolutely right. But I look at this and it's just soft. Mm-hmm. Indictment is in over bid to flip the vote in Georgia. No, trying to overturn our democracy, trying to undo the sanctity of the ballot box. I mean, there could have been, I don't know, a little more sense of urgency, a little more sense of you know, just how important this is, just how historic. No, it was a bid to flip the vote. That's all.
You know, the responses that we saw from Republican statewide officials in Georgia, you know, the response from Governor Kemp, the response from Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger, they didn't cut any corners or pull any punches because they're defending the sanctity of their own work, not just that Donald Trump came into their state and tried to overturn the election result that they believe that they ran fairly, because they did run it fairly. But, you know, they're defending themselves, and they're defending themselves against this accusation. And it's very interesting that his co-partisans, these are Republicans, these are people who will vote for him if he is the Republican nominee. And they're more defensive than the paper of record. Now, of course, the Times has done great reporting on Trump, and they'll continue to do great reporting on Trump. But, you know, these sort of headline gaffes that you see from the Times, or the sort of overly credulous acceptance of Trump's framing that you'll see oftentimes from outlets like the Associated Press, it really should never happen.
Yeah.
And it never happens. You know, the National Review, the Fox News, they never treat Democratic positions the way that New York Times treats entirely bad faith Republican positions. And particularly in the case of Trump, I mean, you know, he's innocent until proven guilty. But if someone applied to work for your radio show and they had a background check came back on them and it showed that they were under four separate federal indictments in three separate jurisdictions facing 91 felony counts, not to mention their other criminal and civil misdemeanors in the past, including a jury in New York finding them liable for rape just a few months ago, you wouldn't hire that person. You wouldn't hire that person to
Greg, I wouldn't let him in my door.
Yeah,
you know, and yet you've got 35% of the country going, he's our guy, we're going down with the ship.
Yeah, I mean, if he's the Republican nominee, there are tens of millions of people who are going to vote for him. And there's an entire media apparatus the sort of symbiotic political and media apparatus that is the right wing echo chamber that will support him to the hilt all the way through.
And what has
and
that?
It's just... No one else would ever be treated that way.
No, you're absolutely right. And, you know, as you said, you know, had Hillary had just a little bit of that kind of treatment, we'd be a different country. But how has the right apparatus handled this this fourth indictment, 91 felony charge? How have they handled it?
You know, this is actually somewhat fascinating. The severity of what Donald Trump stands accused of, and we can reiterate this, he's innocent until proven guilty in our system of justice. But the severity of what he stands accused of really is filtering into parts of the Republican base. We see that in Quinnipiac and Associated Press polling that has come out in the past. I think both of them were this morning or last night and today, where we saw that like very substantial majorities of the public, including majorities of people who identified as Republicans, said that they would not vote for someone who had been convicted of a felony, and that they believed that being convicted of a felony should make you invalid as a candidate for the presidency. That was coming, I think it was 58% of Republicans in one poll said that if you were a convicted felon, you shouldn't be allowed to be president. Not just that they wouldn't vote for you, but that it should be like banned. And so the severity of what he stands accused of, and the weight of the coverage, and the weight of the weight of the accusations and allegations, it really is filtering through. And next week, when we watch the Republicans debate for the first time, and it's not clear whether or not Donald Trump will actually attend that debate, But there are going to be, I believe, four people on that stage at the debate next week, because Mike Pence just qualified for the debate. There are going to be four people who on that debate stage who have said that Donald Trump was wrong, who have said up to that he committed crimes, or that they believe he's guilty of the crimes he's accused of. And they're going to use that stage to take that case right into the Fox News echo chamber. They'll probably be booed. They'll probably spar with the hosts and the debate moderators. They'll probably be shut down by the other members on that stage who are there to defend Trump, like Vivek Ramaswamy, who's essentially just running. He's just running a Trump campaign, more or less. But the right-wing media can't defend constantly against the barrage that Trump faces. They just, frankly, they're starting to give up under the weight of the pressure. We saw this earlier this afternoon. Guy Benson was being interviewed on Special Report on Bret Baier's program on Fox News, and he just seemed sort of downtrodden. They're broken by this. They can't defend Trump because they know that he's guilty of a number of these instances. And so what they're doing is they are really redoubling their efforts to focus on pretend scandals affecting Joe Biden, almost all of which hinge on his son, Hunter.
Yeah. Now, the breaking news today from the right media, since you brought that up, is that Trump said he's going to appoint a special counsel to investigate the Biden family and their corruption. So this is going to be, I guess this is the re-election campaign. Re-elect me so I can go after Joe Biden. I mean, that seems to be all he's got at this point.
And of course, Trump did appoint this special counsel, the individual who was just elevated to the position of special counsel in the Hunter Biden investigation. Was a Trump appointee. Yeah. The U.S. Attorney for Delaware was appointed by Donald Trump specifically to investigate Joe Biden or Hunter Biden. And when President Joe Biden took the office, rather than firing that U.S. attorney, which is commonplace, you replace almost all U.S. attorneys. You let some finish up the work they're doing, and then you replace them with your own political appointees. This guy has been in that office for more than 3 years, entirely at the discretion of the White House. They have not touched that investigation. They have not interfered with it. They have allowed their appointed attorney general now to elevate that investigation to the level of special counsel. Joe Biden is just letting this witch hunt against his son go ahead. And Democrats are not defending Hunter Biden, who seems to be, you know, he seems to be in some real stuff. Like he was going through a really tough part of his life. But the things he stands accused of are pretty serious too. But they're like, they're nothing in comparison to Donald Trump. Hunter Biden is just a guy. He's a private citizen who seems to have made some serious mistakes in his personal life, and who has atoned for them how he could, legally and otherwise. But what the right-wing media wants you to do is they want to turn this into an emails story, right? They want you to hear a cacophony of scandal when you think of Donald Trump. And you can't, it's just an amorphous scandal blob. You can't really attach anything to him. When you think about Joe Biden, they want you to think about Hunter in the same way that when you thought about Hillary Clinton, you thought about emails. Yeah. And so with Trump, it was a million things, a myriad of things that you couldn't quite put your hand. You knew there was something iffy about him, but you didn't really know what it was because there were too many things to focus on. And what with Hillary Clinton, you could just say emails. And that's what happened in the media over and over again. And just as, you know, Trump's crime spree, it is affecting the GOP base. It is bleeding through and it's filtering into their echo chamber. But at the same time, the right-wing media attempts to amplify Hunter Biden, to make him seem like, first of all, he's an important person at all, and also to make that scandal somehow stick to Joe Biden, their efforts are working on the mainstream press. If you watch CNN, if you watch MSNBC, if you pick up a legacy newspaper every day, you'll see daily in the newspaper or hourly on mainstream cable news, you will see coverage of Hunter Biden. And right-wing media are working the refs, and they're complaining to the refs because it works. And so far they have successfully sort of tarnished Biden's presidency with a scandal that literally doesn't exist and is not part of his administration, but that he's been forced to answer for, and that he'll have to spend the next year answering for, because that's how the sort of both sides media works.
Yeah, no, it's crazy where we are. You listen to the Rick Smith Show. We're with Craig Harrington. He's a research director over at Media Matters. You can check out their website, mediamatters.org. We'll get links out on social media. Well, I want to flip this around. Today's the anniversary of the Inflation Reduction Act. The president gave a good, I thought was a good speech for him, you know, talking about issues that speak volumes to me and the need to reshore manufacturing and get into those places that have been forgotten. Any thoughts on the spiel today and the 1 year anniversary?
Yeah, you know, it was actually as a theater critic, right? The media rollout for the White House's anniversary has actually been pretty robust. They've spent several days building up to this. They spent the last several weeks trying to land the Bidenomics message in the public media, and they've more or less had some success getting that picked up because they knew they were leading up to today and the anniversary of this big legislative package that they passed, the Inflation Reduction Act, which is very likely to be the last major legislation of President Biden's first term in office. And it's important to realize that on August 16th of 2022, the day that the Inflation Reduction Act was signed by the president, and a couple of weeks after it had passed in the Congress, inflation was at 8.5%. Today, 1 year after the Inflation Reduction Act was signed and enacted into law, inflation is at 3.2%. And Democrats are trying to make that case. The White House is trying to make that case. Obviously, right-wing media refuse to acknowledge reality. If you watch Fox News, if you read any Trump-aligned outlets or even the sort of DeSantis-aligned outlets like the National Review, they all claim that the economy is in a tailspin and that we might be on the verge of recession if we're not already in recession. They keep highlighting that inflation is out of control, even though it's not. And the mainstream media are struggling to tell this story because it's so easy to point to polling that shows high levels of economic anxiety. So when you ask individuals, particularly Republicans in response to polls, how their economy is doing, how they're doing personally and financially, if their conditions have improved in the last year, they say, of course. And if you ask about the broader economy, this is particularly true of Republicans, but it's somewhat true of everyone else. They say that the whole economy is off track, but personally, they think they're
doing great. Everything else sucks. I struggle with this as well, Craig, because look, I think Joe Biden is taking us in the right direction. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, we're moving away from neoliberalism and allowing corporations to go and move overseas. The idea that we're reshoring manufacturing, all that's great stuff. The fact that bringing back, you know, Davis-Bacon protections so workers can, you know, enjoy better wages. All of this stuff is good stuff, but I still understand that people are struggling. That, you know, homelessness is on a rise. You know, credit card debt's on the rise. Mental health is, you know, problems are on the rise. Suicide rates are on the rise. We've got problems, but we've got to have solutions and a direction other than, well, it's all Joe Biden's fault. It's not, but it's something that has to be addressed.
You know, as a very proud Ohio State Buckeye, it pains me to shout out University of Michigan professor Justin Wolfers, but he's an economist who is quite media savvy, and he's been making a point about this for many months, and he deserves attention for almost single-handedly trying to turn this narrative around in mainstream media, particularly on cable news. But for months, he's been going on television and talking about how all of the indicators we have show that the economy is on the right track and that things are improving. And the public still doesn't believe that that is true, in part because they're not being told that story by the media. You don't have the same number of stories about like how inflation has improved or like how eggs are super affordable or how milk is super affordable. Whereas a year ago or 18 months ago, you know, CNN had that infamous Texas family that buys 12 gallons of milk a month, and they were suffering over $90 of increase in their monthly milk budget or things like that. You know, that story got a ton of attention. You had the stories where journalists would go out and stand next to a gas station and point the camera at the price gauges and show you that, you know, prices are out of control. But you can't do the opposite of that. You can't go to a gas station and point a camera at it and say like, well, look, gas is $3.68, and that's fine, and we're all comfortable with that. And part of it is that the media was so invested in inflation and in looming recession and in economic catastrophe because, you know, if it bleeds, it leads. Yep. That's a good story. People were watching that.
and yourselves.
People don't want to be told. Yeah, absolutely. People don't want to be told that things are getting better. But then at the same time, there is a sort of sunk cost here, right? Like inflation has been dramatically improving steadily for a year. All of the trajectories show that it will likely steady and improve and maintain a baseline going into the future. All of the economists who were forecasting a recession in 2023 or in 2024, all of them have revised their data and are now arguing that a recession is unlikely. The Atlanta Federal Reserve Bank has a GDP forecaster that showed that they expected quarter three GDP to be 5.8% growth, which is like, those are China numbers. That is a shocking growth rate for an entire quarter in the economy. That is not a recession. And, you know, Professor Wolfers on during his appearances often jokes like, if we're in a recession, this is the worst recession ever. It's just not recessioning. But what people do remember is there is a legacy of these impacts, right? Like if you had wages growing at a rate that was below inflation for about 18 months, which was the case in the United States, you need to earn back sort of the area underneath that chart, right? The amount of wages that fell behind is a certain amount. And we haven't quite gained all that back. Now, the Biden administration is telling everyone that we will get right by 2024. And there will be that we're ahead of schedule and the economy is on the right track. And Democrats certainly believe that, at least a majority do. Independents are beginning to come around. But in public polling, Republicans just refuse to acknowledge that the economy is on the right track. And that's why you see these big numbers, these sort of stubborn numbers in public polls that keep getting covered by the Times and by CNN over and over and over again, where they say, well, the public says that the economy is still doing poorly. If you break down that polling, it's always the Republicans who refuse to accept that the economy has improved, or potentially they just represent a different demographic and it hasn't improved for them, though that's unlikely. They refuse to acknowledge that the economy has improved because their guy isn't in office. I guarantee you, if Donald Trump was the president today, Republicans would be saying that the economy was great, because they've been trained to sort of make this a partisan issue by their own media apparatus. And that's an area where the news coverage just hasn't caught up. Every time you see a poll about the state of the economy, that news article almost never breaks down the fact that if you break into crosstabs, you'll see independents are more or less split on the economy. Democrats think the economy is doing pretty well. And then 90% of Republicans tell you that the economy is doing poorly. And they're doing that because, like, it's a political message for them. They refuse to accept that Joe Biden can do anything right. And it shows up in these stories that then have their own inertia.
Yeah. Now, for me, I look at what Biden's doing, and I love the fact that he's addressing the idea of wages on how they have to come up, and not just with rhetoric. I mean, I talked about the Davis-Bacon thing that they just came out with last week sometime, saying, hey, we're going to go back to the original intent of the Davis-Bacon law to ensure that prevailing wages are paid to more workers, so that more workers have the opportunity to make better wage hours conditions, but also that the NLRB is moving backward towards the Joy Silk doctrine. That says, look, when you vote for a union or when you sign a union card, you get the majority of people to sign up. You start negotiating. You don't go through 3, 4, 6 months of harassment and intimidation. This is a very pro-union move and a very pro-worker move, and something that I haven't seen virtually anywhere, except a couple of the places that I check. But this to me is especially for union members, is a huge deal.
Yeah, and I mean, we're in the midst of sort of union summer in the United States. That's one of the most prominent and influential and recognizable unions in the United States. The Screen Actors Guild is on strike in solidarity with their writers, who have been on strike and plan to continue striking for months. We saw prominent railroad strikes. We've seen strikes or threats of strikes and continued organization in the gig economy at major retailers. There's always a sort of looming unionization effort that you see from like big box retailers like Amazon. And you see this gaining steam because people have come to realize that the union, that the labor movement broadly and that unions in particular offer them a real opportunity to get ahead through collective action. Media Matters has unionized. And when I was a member of the bargaining unit, I was very proud to help organize Media Matters, several years ago. We were kind of the leading edge of the sort of union movement among younger workers. And now it's something that's bleeding out into all sectors of the economy and all industries. And it's a good thing for workers. And it's not an accident that this happens after the disruptions of COVID and after the economic turmoil that we saw over the past 3 years, because workers realized they needed to band together. And they're doing so. And they are realizing some of these gains that have been made available in this economic environment. And part of the reason that we're starting to see this kind of proper stabilization of things and wages really beginning to rise is because workers have power and they can make demands. Yep. And they're finally realizing that.
As soon as they realize that they actually have power, maybe things turn around. And as I've been saying, had we all had contracts that had cost of living adjustments in them, as my grandparents' generation had, maybe the inflation that we did suffer under wouldn't have been as painful. And again, this is another one of those things for me. But Craig, as always, I appreciate the time, the thoughts, the expertise, and the work that you guys do over at Media Matters. Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. What are your thoughts? The economy doing well? Are things going in the right direction? How is your economy? That's what I want to hear. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1937. That was the day that the U.S. Congress passed the National Apprenticeship Act. It was also known as the Fitzgerald Act. The purpose of the act was to, quote, formulate and promote the furtherance of labor standards necessary to safeguard the welfare of apprentices. Apprentices are workers learning a skill set. They are typically paid less than skilled workers or journeymen during the course of their training. Apprenticeship programs are especially found in the building trades, where learning skills like plumbing or electrical work might take years of dedicated training. But before the protections of the 1937 Act, there was no national standard governing apprenticeship programs in the United States. This led some apprentices to be exploited. In 1911, Wisconsin became the first state to pass legislation to structure the apprentice system. In the 1920s, multiple labor unions advocated for national apprentice standards to promote fairness and safety for workers. Recognizing the need for national apprentice guidelines, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt commissioned a committee to study the issue. They were tasked with developing training standards for apprenticeship programs. The 1937 law gave the committee the authority to complete their job. The Committee on Apprentice Training became a permanent part of the U.S. Department of Labor. The Bureau of Apprenticeship works with state governments to ensure the fair treatment of apprentices. Today, apprenticeship programs provide classroom and on-the-job training to help develop a skilled labor force. In 2015, 52,500 participants graduated from registered apprenticeship programs. Nearly 500,000 workers participated in apprentice training programs, learning skills that will build their financial security.
Ohio voters scored a big election victory for women's rights last week. It was a tricky vote, too, deceptively couched as a statewide referendum to approve a little technical change in the procedure for approving statewide referendums. How boring. But Ohioans figured out that it really was a big vote on an underhanded ploy by right-wing Republicans to block the right of women to make their own reproductive decisions. Not boring. So, in a huge turnout, a whopping 57% of voters said yes to women and no to the tricksters. Yet the referendum actually did encompass a procedural issue that's an even bigger political story than the election results, namely, the GOP's ongoing attempts to rig election rules so its extremist minority can, quote, win without getting a majority of the votes. Background. A state constitutional amendment guaranteeing the right to abortion is already set to be voted on this November in Ohio. Right-wing Republican leaders, though, fear that more than half of Ohioans will support that amendment. Thus, last week's referendum was their desperate attempt to win by losing, specifically by decreeing that, hocus-pocus, constitutional initiatives must get 60% approval to become law. Yes, a 40% minority of voters could nullify the majority will of the people. This is Jim Hightower saying, this gaming of the system by devious Republican officials and far-right extremists has become their core political strategy across the country. It's actually a deeply embarrassing admission by them. They are conceding that they are now captives of ideological extremism and outright nutballism, making their party so completely out of touch with the American majority that they can't win honestly. So they've become the anti-democracy party, acting as rabid political veterinarians out to fix democracy by neutering the power of the people.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
1-866-416-RICK, 1-866-416-7425. You got a question, comment, something on your mind, want to hear it? Let's go to the phones. Got Jack in Wisconsin on one. Jack, how are we doing today?
Yes, peachy keen, thank you, Rick.
What's on your mind, brother?
I listened to the Biden speech the other day, and it was a very good speech. Biden needs to do this more than once every 6 months or once a month. He needs to do it or have some surrogates doing this every single week, if not every single day. They need to point out that the economy is improving. Many people's wage increases are beating inflation. Inflation, of course, is on the way down. That is a fact. He's done an awful lot, not just for the economy, but for infrastructure. This needs to be emphasized. One of the things that seems to be flying under the radar to me is the fact that there are serious Republican attempts in Congress to undermine this and to damage Biden as much as possible. There's Tuberville supposedly holding up the appointment of the heads of what is it now, the Army, the Marines, and the Navy, I think.
Yeah, hundreds of promotions.
And of course, that has that cascading effect, exactly right. I can see this happening, when the election comes around and any Republican candidate's going to say something like, oh, Biden, he's the commander-in-chief. Why doesn't he have heads for these armed forces?
Yeah.
And, of course, the fact that a Republican sabotaged that is going to be pushed under the table. Similarly, there is the threat to not have a budget by September 30th, which would, again, trash the economy. It had, when they had debt issues, did a pretty good number on the economy as well. And my personal opinion on this, we go back as far as Ronald Reagan in 1981, I think, at his inauguration address, that government isn't the answer, government is the problem, and then instituted this wonderful thing called trickle-down economics, which has never worked. And then later on, there was another Republican, I don't remember who it was, that said, we want government small enough to drown in a bathtub.
That would have been that'd be Grover Norquist.
Yeah, that's okay. That's right. Basically, the whole idea of this is the Republicans have got only one real major platform, and that is give trillions away to their billionaire buddies and huge corporations in terms of welfare tax rates. They have nothing else to sell, so they're going to have to try to damage the government as much as possible. Doesn't make any difference if it hurts us in terms of the individuals, in terms of the country, in terms of our international ability to do things like support Ukraine. They're going to do anything they can to just damage the Democrats. Their idea is break the government and then blame the Democrats.
Yeah, no, I mean, they ran on, this is the thing that's always curious to me, Jack. They run on saying the government can't do anything, shouldn't do anything, the government's horrible, and then they set out to prove that government doesn't work, and then people still vote for them. That's the part that's always curious to me.
Yeah, it's always, people seem to be voting against their best interests in many cases if they vote Republicans, and I'm going back to the past, But right now, the Republican Party has ginned up this incredible tribalism that it doesn't make any difference who the candidate is. They're going to vote for anybody with an R after their name on the ballot. And people, and we've got many people who have been sold on this idea. January 6th, no big deal, nothing happened. Well, yeah, in fact, several people lost their lives. We almost lost our government on that date. But they have been fed this line of baloney from extremist media that says, oh, it was no big deal. Some of the senators saying, oh, it was just a normal tourist visit. Excuse me? I don't think so.
Because, of course, there are normal days when people take a dump on the desk. Happens all the time.
Yeah. We have about a third of the country that is just, they're in this tribal cult. And how we get around that, I do not know. That's my biggest problem. And we have one more problem, and that is Joe Biden is not a young man anymore. And my son always votes, and he's in his 20s. But there are a lot of young people that don't really want to vote for Biden because he's too old for them. That's their only objection. So they won't vote. We've got to get these people out, and we've got to make them see, hey, this is your future. You're going to live to see it. I won't live to see the worst effects of climate change. I won't live to see very much of the fascism if the Republicans take over. But these kids will. Yeah. We've got to somehow get them awake and aware and out to vote and to vote these Republican crazies out.
No, I'm with you, Jack. I appreciate the call, buddy. Thanks so much. He's not wrong. Look, at the end of the day, we've got to figure out how to motivate people to get out and to vote. And look, I'm looking at Biden as the best option at this moment. He wasn't my first choice. But as I've said, he's done much better than I ever imagined, because in my view, we're moving away from all of the stuff that, you know, Jack talked about that moment. The supply side voodoo Reaganomics, that whole neoliberal agenda that got us to where we are. Now the point here is, how do we talk to each other? How do we get out of our silos? Because he's right. Look, there's a third of the country, you know, wearing the red hat saying, you know, everything on the other side is horrible. But understand, you've got some on the other side with the blue hat saying the same thing. For instance, I'm on a listserv of a whole bunch of activists. I want to keep track of what, you know, activists are doing around the country. So I'm on a bunch of these email lists and a bunch of these things where I'm on right wing ones as well, because I want to see what they're saying. Today, this what caught my attention was there's a song on the right wing that you know they're now making the new anthem. This guy Oliver Anthony had, you know, an acoustic song, not really my kind of music, but he had a song that called Richmond North of Richmond, and it's really a working class kind of call to action. If you will, it can be viewed that way. When I'm looking at this, the lyrics to this song, I'm seeing a working guy who's getting screwed and tired of it and is angry. And as I've been saying, the pain, the frustration, the struggle, the anger in these communities across the country is real. The person who figures out how to tap in and make those people's lives better is the party who figures this out. They're going to have loyal voters again. They're going to have loyal voters for years to come. You look back to the New Deal era under FDR. You had FDR Democrats for, you know, even today. You've got people who call themselves FDR Democrats because of the policies, because of what they did, the lives they made better. So as I'm reading through the lyrics of this song, because I'm reading the listserv and I'm hearing, oh, it's racist, it's homophobic, it's all this stuff. You know, it's anti, you know, this, it's, you know, it's against black women, it's all this, whatever colored glasses you were wearing at the time when you heard this song, that's what they picked out of this. And it's frustrating to me because I understand people are struggling. So now, I'm not going to pretend that I know what this guy was thinking by some of the things he said. But, you know, at the beginning, he says, look, I've been selling my soul, working all day, overtime hours for BS pay. So I can sit out here and waste my life away, drag back home and drown my troubles away. This is a working person who is struggling to make ends meet. This is someone who's having a tough time. He says, it's a damn shame what the world has gotten to for people like me, people like you. Wish I could wake up and it not be true, but it is. He says, living in the new world with an old soul, these rich men north of Richmond, and he's talking about people in D.C., Lord knows all they want to do is have total control, want to know what you think, want to know what you do, and they don't think you know, but you know you do, that kind of stuff, because your dollar ain't blank, and it's taxed to no end because of the rich men north of Richmond. He said, I wish politicians would look out for miners, like the people going down in the ground, and not just miners on some island. Lord knows folks in the street ain't got nothing to eat, and the obese milk and welfare. God, if you're a 5'3", you're 300 pounds, taxes ought not to pay for your bag of fudge rounds. Young men putting themselves 6 feet underground, because all this damn country does is keep kicking them when they're down. This is someone who's angry at what has happened to working people in this country. Now, I find it interesting he goes after welfare recipients and not corporate ones. He goes after, and what's interesting is everyone's like, well, he's talking about black women. I didn't hear that. It could be the people that he sees in trailer parks too, because white people are poor and living in horrible poverty conditions. And the narrative is, well, they're just sucking off the government teat. Policy-wise, there are a ton of things we should be doing to help folks who are struggling. But this to me seems, and now the right's going to pick this up as an anthem and do exactly what the left wants them to do. And this is the weird spot for me that I'm in, because it seems like, you know, now it's pushing this on them that they're going to defend it. And for me, it's, I see the pain. I see the fact that he's struggling. And he's mad. And he's mad at other poor people, which is weird. Like I said, brings up welfare, milk and welfare. Never mentioned the corporations who are paying him the BS wages. I mean, there are real things to argue about this song. None of which are the things that are divisive to us. And for me, there is a way to reach people. When we did our Working Class Heroes tour and we went through Wisconsin, we went through Iowa, we talked to people who, they're angry. They believe that they're being fed and taxed enough to already. They believe that the government isn't there to help them. Because you've had a Republican Party for so long who will do nothing for them and tell them, look, we're doing nothing for you. Screw you. You're on your own. We're going to get your pay or die health insurance. That's the best you're getting out of us. And you've got a Democratic Party who's going, well, you know, you're over there. You're run by red states and red governors who refuse to help you. What do you want from us? And they feel angry and they feel left out. I'll tell you, we went through Iowa, and Iowa for me was a major wake-up call. You know, I've always thought this way, and I've always believed, you know, when we deindustrialized, the jobs that were lost and the families that were broken and all that stuff, I've always been there. But it wasn't until we went through Iowa and we saw the devastation of communities and the fact that these people are struggling to maintain their dignity. Because look, nobody wants to admit that they're struggling. Nobody wants to admit that they're having a hard time. They want the pride that comes with being able to make their way. And I'd say the same thing about people on welfare. Look, you know, when I was a kid, I don't remember people celebrating the fact that they needed food stamps. One of the most traumatic, if I have any trauma, one of the most traumatic moments of my life was having to go to a store and use food stamps, the clown money they used to give you. And the woman behind the counter just humiliating an 8-year-old child. That should happen to no one. You should be able to take no one's dignity away. And this is what these folks are feeling. And I guess I understand it a little bit better than my friends who wear the blue hat all the time. The best way I think to deal with some of this is to actually reach out to people. So everyone goes, well, how do we do that? By admitting that their struggles are real, by admitting that, you know, in the past, bad decisions were made, owning up to failures and talking about how we make that better. And I think Biden today in his speech did some of that. I watched his speech today and it was like something that I would have written. Because he did hit on those themes. He did talk about communities that were left behind. Because he said, look, I'm asked all the time, why are you investing in red states? Why is any of this money going there? And look, I've said it before. He's a better man than I am. I can be as vindictive as anybody else. But he's saying, look, it's about all of the country. And it's about those places that are hit hardest. It's about those places that are struggling to find their identity, their pride. And look, the reason I like this guy so much is because I think he gets that. I think he gets that on a visceral level. It's not something you can fake. So for me, as I've said, I'm guardedly optimistic about what the future is going to bring us. I'm hoping that we continue on the path that we're on. And I hope come 2024, we stay the course. Want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back after this to wrap things up. Stick around. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1894. That was the birthday of the longtime leader of the AFL-CIO, George Meany. Meany grew up in the Bronx with his Irish Catholic family. His father was the president of the United Association of Plumbers and Pipe Fitters. Meany left school at the age of 16 and signed on as an apprentice with the pipe fitters. 10 years later, he was elected as the youngest member of the union's executive board. Within 2 years, he entered full-time union work, becoming a business agent. In 1934, he took the reins as president of the New York State Federation of Labor. 5 years later, he became the secretary treasurer of the American Federation of Labor. At the AFL, Meany played an important role in the international labor movement. He helped to form the International Confederation of Free Trade Unions at the end of World War II. Meany then became president of the AFL in 1952. As president, Meany helped to lead the merger of the AFL and the CIO in 1955. The merger brought 15 million working people together into one association. Meany was known for his anti-communist positions and for having little patience for union radicalism. He was vocal in pushing for protections against employment discrimination in the historic 1964 Civil Rights Act. He also supported the passage of the 1970 Occupational Safety and Health Act. The act brought safer workplace standards to millions of workers throughout the country. Meany became the face of the labor movement, quite literally. Twice he appeared with his trademark cigar on the cover of Time magazine. He remained at the helm of the AFL for a quarter of a century, retiring in 1979. He died in 1980, but he will be remembered as one of the nation's strongest voices for human and civil rights. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. So, story on Friday that I didn't catch until Monday that got almost... I didn't see any real national coverage of this, but evidently a 3-year-old child died on a bus going from Texas to Chicago because of Greg Abbott's, what are they calling that now? Operation Lone Star. It's where they're busing up a bunch of, you know, migrants and they're shipping them to Democratic cities. In fact, you know, last week it's been reported that, according to Mexican officials, that two people drowned in the Rio Grande. Including a child, and I guess their bodies got caught up in these floating barriers that have look like giant bandsaw or circular saw blades, and I'm going, wow, the level of cruelty. Now, you know, what they don't know what killed this 3-year-old child, And it, again, it just it goes to show how screwed up our immigration policies are. It goes to show how screwed up our political system is that we can't get something to at all done. But it does show me that the party who cares about the children, because they love the children, the pro-life people, not so much. And, you know, they've covered their behind. Evidently, waivers were signed. And they're claiming it's all purely voluntary. Just not how you treat people. And look, I've said before, I don't have the answer on the immigration issue. I don't. I'm not someone who says you swing the doors open, but I'm also someone who says you can't slam the door shut. We need policies that are going to help people want to stay home. You know, some of that helpful. But this, I don't know. The amount of money being wasted on all of this is frustrating. Now, a governor who I think is doing good things. I look at Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro, who just the other day signed into law a universal breakfast program for all children in the Commonwealth. That is a good thing. And I guess, you know, we're going to have universal lunch program as well. That's universal breakfast is happening. Now it'd be great if we could go the full rest of the way, which I believe that is part of this, breakfast and lunch. And they estimate that this is going to help, what, it was 1.7 million kids in the Commonwealth? 1.7 million kids? That's an important thing. And I'm thrilled to see that. Good on Josh Shapiro. And finally, Leaky Rudy. Evidently, Rudy Giuliani and his legal team are claiming Rudy's broke. He's selling his apartment because he's got legal fees to pay. And what I find interesting is, I was looking through some of the costs, I'm going, man, being Donald Trump's friend is really expensive. Being his lackey, really expensive. Evidently, he's been saying he's their bills, $90,000 in sanctions from a judge in one defamation case, $20,000 monthly fee for data hosting because of all the things that he's got himself into, $57,000 in unpaid phone bills. $89,000 in legal bills, just over the case with the two Georgia poll workers, and then the list goes on. I mean, the guy's just—he's hair dye deep in bills, and you know who's not helping him? And there's where the poetic justice is for me, because again, I look at someone like Donald Trump, and I've known con artists like that before. They never reach into their pocket. You know, everything's on the arm. You know, everything is somebody else's responsibility. And that when you get into trouble, they just move mosey on down the road. And if you were one of the best people that got suckered into being part of Trump's world, I have no sympathy for you whatsoever when he refuses to help you with the legal costs. And this, I think, is going to play into the thought process of all of the unnamed co-conspirators, and some of the named ones as well. Because here's the one thing that everyone knows: legal costs really expensive. Unless you're going to get fresh, you're going to get Cousin Vinny to come defend you, and you're going to get your first case. It's going to be expensive, and these legal bills, they mount. And it's going to be interesting to see how many people actually do flip because they can't afford to defend themselves. Now, as I said earlier, you know, I wish it were about democracy. I wish it were, hey, you know, he broke the law. He has to be. I wish it were the high-minded stuff. I wish it were, the right and wrong. Because, again, these are the Republicans have always framed themselves as the paternalistic, law and order, black and white, good and bad, right and wrong. You know, it's them. Yeah. And then to have this is, well, curious. So I do find it interesting that Rudy broke. I also find it interesting that he's being named in a RICO indictment, considering that he made his name and his millions, you know, because of his use of the RICO Act when he was, you know, putting away mobsters in New York. There's got to be a movie. There's got to be a documentary about Rudy. There really does. I have no explanation on how you go from, you know, super prosecutor to America's mayor to now indicted co-conspirator. That's worth, you know, that's worth an
hour. You're listening to The Shaw. WAUK 540 AM Jackson. W266 DR Waukesha. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.